Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to KXE. If I've not met you before, my name's Pete. I'm part of the staff team here at KXE. Have we got the slides for the screen? Hey, thank you, mate. So tonight, my job is to land the teaching series that we've been in over the last 6 weeks on emotionally healthy spirituality. We've been tracking through a brilliant book by a guy called Pete Scazzaro, which is well worth picking up and reading, even in hindsight, and going back to it after the end of the series. We'd really encourage you to read it. And we've been working on the basis that is his tagline, which is it's not possible to be spiritually mature whilst remaining emotionally immature. And the whole series, I think, I've absolutely loved this series. I think it's been profound. I've loved every single one of the talks. I can say that because I haven't given any of them. But it's been an extraordinary time. And just even anecdotally from meeting with people over the last 6 or so weeks in the church, something is going on. We've had more listens on the podcast than any other month before. Something is going on. People are hungry to meet with God in their emotional life. I really, really believe that. And it's absolutely critical that we do so. Our series has been about saying, like, Jesus cares deeply about those areas of our emotional life, those shadows in our life that we try and hide. Well, he wants access to them because he is light, and he wants to shine light into them, and he wants to heal them. And so he's saying, I want all of you. I want to bring life to all of you. And just over the series, it's really reminded me of this moment in the Gospels, which is when the disciples go to Jesus and say, would you teach us how to pray? Would you teach us how to pray? And he goes on to teach them the Lord's Prayer. And it's an extraordinary moment, and it's shaped the world since. Those words have shaped the world since. But just before he gives them the actual prayer, he says this sentence: do not pray like the hypocrites. And in this sentence, I think, is so much of what this series has been about, and so much of the key to relating to God. Because I would love us as a church to be different off the back of this series. Not just 6 great talks for the sake of it, but for there to be actual transformation and change. And I think in this verse here contains some of the principles behind that. And so, do not pray like the hypocrites. That's his advice. It's almost like, before I tell you how to pray, I want to just say this: do not pray like the hypocrites. And the hypocrites, the Greek word there is hypocrates. And hypocrates was a very specific word in that culture. And it meant actor, but a very specific type of actor. So they had stage acting. And a hypocrates was a technical word for an actor who would act on their own. So there'd be one person in the play. And what they would do, they would act by picking up different masks. So they would pick up the angry master to convey anger. They'd pick up disappointment to convey that, excitement, whatever it would be. They would act with masks on. So the audience, those watching the actor, the hypocrates, the hypocrite, as we've now come to know it, would never see the face, the true face of the actor. They would only ever see masks. And Jesus is saying, it's almost like this is the soil that I want you to pray out of, so to speak. Like, this is the bedrock of everything. Don't come to me with a mask on. Do not pray like that actor who never lets the audience see their true face. Do not pray to me like that. If you want to come to me, I want you to come to me. Come to me as you. Don't fake it. Don't have a mask on. Take the mask off. Come as the real you, with shame, with pain, with excitement, with hopes that you don't dare to dream about. Whatever it might be, let me see you. Let me see you. It's the basis of our prayer life. It's the basis of our relationship with Jesus. It's the only way we will ever feel truly loved. It's the only way we'll ever really experience the power of the cross, is if we don't hold up a mask and fake it, but let him actually see the real us. And throughout this series, just over this last week, I've been reading, tipping into this book by Brennan Manning called Abba's Child. And if you haven't read it, I'd encourage you to read it. It's extraordinary. And it's basically this book about... Jonah's read it. He got the nod. It's this book he's basically talking about, The Imposter, which is this whole idea that, like, God couldn't possibly love the real me. So what I'll do is I will create an imposter. Like, this is what I'll present to God. Maybe he'll love that person. Faking it, wearing masks, essentially. I just want to read you a couple of little bits of the book because I think they're extraordinary. To ignore, repress, or dismiss our feelings is to fail to listen to the stirrings of the spirit within our emotional life. Jesus listened. In John's gospel, we're told that Jesus was moved with the deepest emotions. The gospel portrait of the beloved child of Abba is that of a man exquisitely attuned to his emotions and uninhibited in expressing them. The Son of Man did not scorn or reject feelings as fickle and unreliable. No, they were sensitive antennae to which he listened carefully and through which he perceived the will of his Father. How much of our lives have we spent just pushing down emotions? Like, that obviously isn't valid. God couldn't like that in me, so I'm going to keep it a secret. I'm going to present this person instead. Brennan Manning and Jesus are saying, no, don't do that. And then he goes on to say this: we unwittingly project onto God our own attitudes and feelings towards us. If we're angry with ourselves, we think God must be. If we're disappointed in ourselves, we think God must be. It's the heart, it's the source of why we push them down and hide them, because it couldn't possibly be the case that God could love me if I'm like that. So we unwittingly project onto God our own attitudes and feelings towards ourselves, but we cannot assume that he, God, feels about us the way we feel about ourselves, unless, of course, we love ourselves compassionately, intensely, and freely. Do you recognize that in your life, just projecting onto God? He must think of me like this. He must see me like this. He couldn't possibly love me if I'm like this. And he concludes by saying this: define yourselves then, define yourselves radically as one beloved by God, with the mask off. This is the true self. Every other identity, every other mask is illusion. If we conceal our wounds out of fear and shame, our inner darkness can neither be illuminated nor become a light for others. It's the heart of this series. Let God in. Let him see you with the mask off. Where you've got the imposter in your life saying, that's who God must love. Get rid of them. It's you he loves. Let him see you. Let him gaze into your eyes without the mask on. Let him love you. I think you will be changed. And as it says here, become a light also for others. But tonight, I want to do in landing this series, which has been amazing, and there have been six great talks and all of that, and there's been moments where the heart has beaten a little faster because you think God is speaking to you, and you know that pain has surfaced in your life, or shame has surfaced to be healed, or maybe a dream has been resurrected that you didn't hold on to any longer. Whatever it might have been, at whatever point in the series, there's probably been moments, we hope, that God has spoken to you. And if you're here for the first time, I'd really encourage you to go back and listen to the talks. But tonight I want to ask you, now what? So we've had all that. We've had six talks. We've gone to all these places with God. Now what? Because we're certainly not interested in putting on a series for the sake of a series. We really want this church to be different going forward. Where the world is constantly putting on masks, we want this church to take them off. And believe we'll be radically changed if we do. So what do we do now, each and every one of us? And here's a really very real possibility. Within 2 weeks, maybe three, life's carried on, you've gone back to work, you're looking after kids, we've maybe done a new teaching series, whatever it might be, and it's just faded away. It's just gone. I can't even particularly remember. I know there were these moments where I walked out of church and was like, wow, I've got to do that. But now I can't even remember what they were. And you'd be surprised by this. I would have had a little whip around the staff team, and you'd be surprised by how quickly these things fade in people's minds. So I'm encouraging you to reflect on this series. So one option is that it's just faded away, right? It happens all the time. I mean, I've been a Christian for 16 years. Hear a great talk, but it's faded by a couple of weeks in. The other option is a little bit worse than that. Actually, you're like, hey, you had real hopes for change in your life on the back of this series. And then 2-3 months in or whatever it is, you feel like you're in the same place. That thing hasn't happened and you slip into disappointment and all of that sort of thing. That in the coaching world, or at least our friends over at Spear who coach people for change, essentially, they call that the 6 o'clock abyss. You fall into the 6 o'clock abyss. Anyone heard of the 6 o'clock abyss? Yes, Spear. Spear, Zulum, because he's a legend. Anyway, so 6 o'clock abyss. Let me talk to you about this. It's a really amazing diagram I made earlier. So that's a clock face, in case you hadn't figured it out. Anyway, 1 o'clock, that's the Sunday night. That's the talk. That's that moment of truth coming into your life, the moment of revelation, the Spirit speaking to you. Let's say it's Tim May's talk on the Sabbath and about time. And you're like, whoa, wow, that's me. I need that is truth for me. I know I need that in my life. So that's 1 o'clock. And then 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock, where we to make it, is your regularly Sabbathing. And it's changing you and it's changing the world around you. That would be like transformation. That would be change further around. But what I want to talk to you about is this bit here, which is you've heard this amazing thing. You've gone home and you're like, you've heard this talk on patience and you're going like, bring on the guy at work. I don't even care. Like, I'm going to be so patient this week. Or bring on the kids, the little angels created by God, image of God. Like, I'm never going to lose it this week. And then Monday happens and Tuesday happens, etc. And you fall into the 6 o'clock abyss because you do lose it with them. Sabbath, you're like, bring on Saturday. Nothing but candles. It's going to be beautiful. And then you get there and then there's a work email that comes in. You never actually turned off your... 6 o'clock abyss. 6 o'clock abyss is characterized by disappointment, shame, guilt. You start to think about yourself. You have a wrong view of yourself. Like, I can't change. Or like, I don't think I'm loved by God. Or like, it doesn't seem to work in my life. Like he is in the other person's life. You start to compare to other people. So you have a wrong view of self, wrong view of others. And you have a wrong view of God, which is he doesn't love me. He doesn't want to work in my life. He's obviously his spirit. You know, that person who manifests all the time. He's more in them than he is in me, etc., etc. And what you really end up doing is you trade what is the spirit of possibility, the Holy Spirit, this whole idea that just you're more than conquerors when the Holy Spirit is in you, for a spirit of probability. It probably won't change. I probably will still be like this, so I may as well not try. You adopt and live with the status quo. That thing you had so hoped on that 1 o'clock moment on that Sunday would change hasn't. And so you just say, I'll just live with it then. And you start to walk with a limp and a slightly bad back over years, spiritually, that is, of like, you just live with the thing that you know is not quite right, but you're just going to live with it anyway. You adopt the status quo. You settle for it. Because you've been in the 6 o'clock abyss, then you hear another great talk on a Sunday, and then you're like, come on, this time, and then you fall in again, and it feels deeper this time, and you can't get yourself back out. Does anyone recognize this pattern in your spiritual life? I feel like I've lived in it a lot. Johnny's there with me. It's a real thing, right? I think it's a real thing. I think we spend a lot of time there. So I want to ask, okay, with the 1 o'clock moment in this series, with the stuff that God has stirred in you, how can we take a step towards that not happening? Not promising a formula tonight that will mean that they won't happen, but I just want to talk through some principles, and it's going to be a really practical talk tonight to help us live differently with Jesus in the power of the Spirit after this. But before we do that, to hold on to it, what has been your 1 o'clock moment in this series? If you've been here and you've listened to the talks, what has been your 1 o'clock moment? To give you a moment just to reflect. Like, what is the thing, that heart-racing moment, that absolute conviction, that thing that was surfaced? What's the thing? What's the truth? What lie was denounced in this series? If you need some help, here's a few that I thought of over this last week. Pete talked about being, you know, that whole idea of being hard-hearted? That was essentially about, like, I have so suppressed these feelings that if someone's asked me, how are you doing, I couldn't even tell them. I've just numbed it. Might be that God has been speaking to you about that. Or inviting you to go back, to go forward, going back to those points of pain or anything that's happening in your past in order to be able to move forward with Jesus, redeemed. We've been invited in this series to forgive others. We've been invited in the series to become honest with God, to take off the mask. We've been invited to transform our pain and the power and the love of Jesus rather than transmit it and put it onto others. We've been invited to rest and Sabbath, to disrupt false harmony for the sake of peace. We so often live with things and keep them just fine without dealing with the thing underneath. Jesus wants us to be peacemakers, to get into that mess, disrupt it for the sake of peace and healing. We've been invited to confess our sins, to shatter our pride. There will have been shame that surfaced in you. Maybe it's that. We've been invited to end an addiction to busyness, to eliminate hurry in our life, to exist in community, to love others, not just find people who are like ourselves and like ourselves in the other, but to find people who are genuinely other and love them. End narcissism, which is about a world orientating just around ourselves and our needs. We've invited to become a non-anxious present because of the risen Jesus in your life, so in your workplace, in your school, wherever it might be. We've invited to see others as thou and not it. Thou people are people who are made in the image of God, your fellow brother and sister. It people are people you can use and abuse to get somewhere in life. Invited to see people as thou. And we've invited to embrace solitude. That's just a scattering of some of the things. This is what I mean, like in 2 weeks, we might not have even remembered half of those. So, can you recognize what your 1 o'clock moment has been in this series? That moment where truth broke into your life. Pete Scazzaro, on the back of all these chapters, he lands it with a chapter, which is his conclusion of what now? His answer to what now? It's really the same conclusion that most spiritual giants have made since the church began, which is to form a rule of life. Form a rule of life. So what is a rule of life? So let's talk about this. So that word rule, it can be a bit intimidating. It can seem contrary to grace and all of that. It comes from the same Greek word as the word we get trellis from. Trellis as in a gardening. Trellis. Nobody looked like they knew what that was. But yeah, people know what trellis is? Yeah, so the Greek word, kasphoto, basically means straight stick. So you get a ruler from that, but you also get trellising. Trellising, you plant it in the soil right next to the thing you want to grow, and it helps it grow up in a certain direction, towards the sun, over the arch of the doorway. Whatever it is, it's growing in the direction you want it to grow. You plant something, a straight stick, a rule, a thing, a physical thing, so that thing can grow. That's what trellising is. It's what a rule of life is. And rule of life is essentially a set of practices, embodied practices, things we do to put trellising up in our lives, let the right things grow. Scazzaro puts it like this: we are called to order our lives around spiritual practices and disciplines. Trellising is a call to order our lives in such a way that the love of Christ comes before all else. It rises above all other plants. In doing so, the very quality of our lives hold the possibility of being transformed into a gift to our families, friends, co-workers, and communities. Rule of life, practices, disciplines, things embodied acts. So not just knowledge, but then doing something about it that helps that thing grow, that truth. And I said the spiritual giants all did it. They started with the early church. So Acts 2 we're in. Spirit of God has been poured out. Thousands have come to know Jesus. These people have had their lives totally, totally transformed by the love and sacrifice of Jesus Christ. They're totally new, born again. And there's thousands of people come to know Jesus. And what is it that they do? Well, the next bit in the passage is it says the fellowship of the believers. And it says this: they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching. That's a practice. That's a bit of trellising. It's about studying. It's about the truth. It's about teaching and all of that. And to fellowship, regularly gathering together, not going it alone, but gathering together. That's a bit of trellising. To the breaking of bread, that's the Lord's Supper. That's a bit of trellising. And to prayer. And by prayer, it means prayers, which is three times a day, which is what Jesus did. This is what they did. They're like, okay, we've just had our lives radically transformed. He's given us the gift of the Holy Spirit. We are his hands and feet. We are the church. They didn't have the New Testament. They were making it. And they say, what should we do? Set up this trellising to make sure the right things, the things of the kingdom, grow in us. We know what we're like. Without it, the wrong things will grow. So that's what a rule of life is. It's trellising, it's physical embodied acts in our life to allow the truths of the kingdom, the things of the spirit to grow in our lives. That's what we're talking about here. But why do we need rules of life? Why do we need this trellising? Ignore point one. I had a criminally long talk in the first service and I've just cut it out. So if you want to know about it, ask me in Camino. Point two of three is this. You need to do this, I would say. I need to do this because of the formational power of this city that we live in and love living in most of the time. But it is a formational machine. It is a formational machine. What won't make sense is the concrete rabbi, because it was in point one. Essentially, it's a formation machine. Let me tell you why. This is borrowed from our friend John Mark Comer, who's just always helpful. So he talks about unintentional spiritual formation. This is the whole idea that if you just wake up tomorrow and live your life, don't do anything particularly different, you will be shaped. You will be formed. You will grow into the likeness of something or someone. The question is, into whose likeness? So this is unintentional spiritual formation. It's just what happens. We are always being shaped. He puts it down to these things, the stories that we're immersed in. So just always immersed through the narrative of a workplace, the narrative of a family, the narrative of a university, the narrative of your degree, the narrative of the marketing in the city, whatever it might be. You are immersed. We are all immersed in stories, narratives, narratives of what beauty is, of success is, of what your where direction your life should be going, whatever it might be. You're immersed in stories all the time. One guy put it that we're in the story wars. The best story wins. One of the factors in unintentional spiritual formation. The second one is habits, daily rituals, little patterns of living. So the city enrolls you in these. You don't actually sign up to it. The city just enrolls you in them. You've got to live in a certain way, probably in a smaller place than you might have wanted. You've got to travel in a certain way across the city. There's little ways of being, whether it's down to time and space or how we socialize and how we spend our money, all these different things. They're daily, unnoticeable most of the time, habits that we are constantly immersed in. They are shaping us, along with the narratives and the relationships, the people that we're around. You become like the people that you're around. That was the whole point. The rabbi thing is that the whole point of the disciples was to be apprentices of Jesus, being with him, immersing themselves in his world, becoming like him in how, in their character, in how they think and how they perceive the world, and then to go and do the things that he did. That's what being a rabbi was all about. That's how you discipled. And the city acts like a concrete rabbi. You're immersed in it the whole time, its narratives and habits. And the reality is we then become like it and we start to live out the same things. Does that make sense? So that is what unintentional spiritual formation is all about and why we need to put up trellising, because the city has plenty of trellising in already. And so this is what it does. When you're immersed in all those narratives, those stories, those relationships, they form in you over time your loves, your allegiances, your affections. The thing, if you might form a love of money or a certain image of success or beauty, or you might form a love of comfort. And so what you do is, perhaps if I've grown up in a very privileged background, I've been immersed in comfort most of my life. So I probably, when it comes between choice A and choice B, in that little bit of my day, that day, I probably choose comfort A. And it means it moves us. These things get a hold of us at the deepest core, and we're not static. We move in their direction, and I start to spend my life actually living after comfort, which is a rival kingdom to the kingdom of God. There's all sorts of rival kingdoms out there of all the things I keep mentioning. So these stories, habits, relationships, they get a hold of us at a deep level. It's why in Proverbs it talks about, above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. It's why Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount talks all about the heart, because these things are getting a hold of us and they're moving us in a certain direction. The crucible of our formation is in the anonymous monotony of our daily routines. Waking up, living life, being shaped. We need to learn a way. We're talking about why we need trellising, why we need these practices. We need to learn a way of being in this world that transforms us day by day. Into which direction? The kingdom of God. Into whose likeness? Jesus. We've got to be intentional about it. We've got to be intentional about it. You're going up one trellis. You may as well make it Jesus's one. So into whose likeness and towards what kingdom? This is about, yeah, so Ruth Rayo talks about sleep, walking into a certain way of being. Do we know how we've ended up living, how we're living, and why? Too often we find ourselves on the treadmill of life, paying the consequences for choices we hardly knew we were making. You just wake up in London 3 years in. Oh, I've actually become quite like this, and I didn't even mean to. I've become this certain type of husband or employee or disciple. It's sleepwalking into a certain shape. This is the thing. Inaction and action both shape us. Inaction on forgiveness shapes us. Action on forgiveness shapes us, i.e. not forgiving shapes us. It just doesn't shape us in the likeness of Jesus. Forgiving does shape us in the likeness of kingdom. There is no such thing as a void where we are not shaped. We are always being shaped. So my encouragement is, this is why we need it. Desert fathers and mothers recognize this. So the early church needed trellising in their life, needed these practices, embodied acts, because they were being persecuted. But by the time we get to the Desert Fathers and Mothers in, I think, the 6th century, the empire had become Christian, so the threat was not persecution. The threat was becoming quite Greek or Roman. And the desert fathers and mothers were these crazy people who recognized this. They recognized how they're being shaped by the culture around them. Their solution, which isn't the one I'm necessarily encouraging you to do, was to move out of the city and into the desert. Our hope is that we bring the desert into the city. We find ways of doing what they learned to do and were the pioneers of contemplation, silence, solitude, all of these practices, these trellises, and we bring them into the heart of the city. But anyway, they figured it out. They realized they were growing in the wrong way, so they left that environment and set up all these trellising. And I'll come back to them in a minute because they were extraordinary. So why do we need trellising? Why do we need a rule of life? Because of the formational power of the city. Third thing, because the journey inward is the journey outward. We are passionate here at KXE, if you haven't heard us say it, about the renewal of all things. We want to see us transformed, sure, but also the world and all of culture around us. We're passionate about that. So I want to talk about the inner world and the outer world just really briefly. The outer world is always growing. Your outer world is always growing. As you get older, your outer world grows. And this is what happens. Let's say you get married. That might not be what you are meant to do, but if you are, then you're not just responsible for yourself. There's someone else in your life. So stakes go higher. Then if you do have kids, and you might not, but were you to do that, then there's little people running around you you've also got to care for. And so the stakes get higher. The pressure increases. The responsibility increases. Our outer world, it might be that you get that promotion at work, if that's something that you're going after. You might get the job you'd always hoped for. Whatever it is, by addition, your outer world just grows with time. The pressure, the stakes, the responsibility, right? It also grows by absence. So not just addition, but also by absence, because those things that you had hoped for didn't happen. And so as you're waiting, the question grows louder and stronger about why not, or whatever it might be. Do you see what I mean? It's not just through addition, but absence. As you get older, your outer world grows. And what I want to say is we've got to build our inner world. We've got to strengthen our inner world as our outer world grows, because otherwise it crushes in on it. And we've all had many crises where our outer world crushes in on our inner world, where we didn't make it resilient enough. We didn't know ourselves well enough. So we burn out, whatever it might be. And we've all got examples probably of this happening on a major scale in lives. So my plea is your outer world is growing. There is more responsibility, more at stake, more pressure, more people you've got to think about. Let's pay attention. We cannot afford to not pay attention to our inner world. It's absolutely critical. But there's a second thing here. If we want a shot at shaping the city, we have to make the journey inward, because the journey inward is the journey outward. So what we have done with these practices through a chunk of time in the church is we made them very inward looking. So we made them very inward, about us and our change. Now, they are that, but they're not that. And so this is from Carl David Bennett, who says this: for Christians before us, i.e. the entirety of church history, this is just a short bit where we distorted it, but for Christians before us, these disciplines were not primarily or exclusively practiced for the goods they offer each of us as individuals. Rather, they were practiced for others, to help and benefit others. They were seen as acts of love towards one's neighbor that bring life and health and vitality to the world. They were seen as practices that discipline us to positively impact our neighbor's livelihood and concretely change the conduct of the communities of which we are a part. As we become more patient, it is a gift to our neighbor. As we become more courageous because we know Christ's voice in our life, it's a gift to our workplace and to our communities. The point is, the journey inward is the journey outward. As we are shaped into the likeness of Christ, we will be Christ to the world. We cannot afford to neglect our inner world. We have a pursuit of the outer. We cannot neglect the inner. And back to our beloved mothers and fathers. They move out to the desert, right? And this is the great irony of the whole movement. They move out there because they're growing up the wrong trellis. They set up new trellises to be a sign, foretaste, instrument of the kingdom of God. And the thing is that the desert, ironically, becomes a city. Because Little by little, people go out to the desert to speak to these people, and you can read all about the conversations they have. It's extraordinary. But and they ask them these questions about life, and they give these wise answers, and they realize they've not got the mindset of the empire. They've got the mindset of somewhere else. And so one by one, they start going and taking a tent and pitching a tent next to this person's tent, and they start to move into the cave next door to the other person in the cave, and slowly the desert becomes a city. They paid attention to their inner world, and it became attractive. It became that their distinctiveness was their relevance. Sometimes I think we try and abandon our distinctiveness to be relevant to the world around us. Our distinctiveness is our relevance to the world around us. Our journey inward matters because the journey outward matters. But the journey outward, being a teacher, being a barrister, being a student, being a designer, whatever it might be, we don't just want teachers in the workplace. We want Christ-like teachers in the workplace. We don't just want barristers, we want Christ-like barristers. This is why it's important. It's not just the outward journey. If we neglect the inner journey, we become teachers that look like other teachers. We've got to be distinct to become relevant. The inner world is critical to the outer world. So I've talked a bit about what a rule of life is, trellising. I've never said that word so much in my life. Anyway, trellising. Why? Because of the formational power of this city. And because the inward journey is the outward journey, critical. Now I want to talk about why we might struggle to do this, because we all struggle to do this. Because doing so is costly. Forming these practices, these countercultural, Tim talked about Sabbath as resistance in his talk. Like, just go back to that and listen to that, about how it is countercultural as you practice this thing. Doing these practices is costly. This is why, because thinking costs little, but acting costs everything. Just to be in here in this room and have that 1 o'clock moment where you're like, wow, that is so true. It doesn't cost us anything until the moment we try and live it out. And that is why so many of us won't live it out, me included. It costs us. I was interviewing a young, brilliant theologian this week for a podcast. Watch this space. And she said this thing. She was like, we love orthodoxy, but neglect orthopraxis. So that's very theologian speak. Orthodoxy, right thinking, theology, the truth. We love that stuff, but we neglect orthopraxis, which is the outworking of it, the practice of the thing that is true. So she said, she was talking about how we sit in church and we polish the truth until it's just perfect in our life. Like, yes, forgiveness, yes. I think we can all sign up to that. That will change the world. But leaving church and phoning the mum you haven't spoken to in 3 years and say, I forgive you. Or taking the colleague aside at work and saying, I forgive you. Or going and asking for forgiveness from someone. Now that is costly. It'll be one of the number one reasons why we do not do what I'm asking us to do. Because it is costly, me included. One reason why we struggle is costly. Second reason, because change is slow. Change is slow. I'm pretty convinced we want the best and the most by doing the least, the quickest. I certainly recognize that all over my life. We want the best thing we can possibly have, the most we can possibly have, doing the least, and doing the least, the quickest. You may not recognize that in your life. I certainly recognize it in mine, but here's how the scriptures talk about transformation. We will be transformed into Christ's image from one degree of glory to another. One degree at a time. One degree at a time. And one degree doesn't feel like much. It feels slow. And the thing is with this, as one person was talking about this, of like, if you have a baby, you don't expect to wake up the next morning and then be an adult, right? Like that. But over there, like, there will be moments of growth spurt. There'll be moments where they are radically changed. They radically mature. There will be key moments like that. But the vast majority of the trajectory of their life is it takes years, one degree of glory to the next. The same with the spiritual life. There'll be moments of radical healing, radical breakthrough. But the vast majority, the pattern of change in our lives will generally be slow. Now, I am not saying we settle for little by little. I'm not saying that. A big vision for transformation. It's not about settling for it, but it is the reality. Eugene Peterson puts it like this. Discipleship is a long obedience in the same direction. That way. Just Jesus. Just keep going towards Jesus. Get knocked down. Go back. Like, trip over. But keep going in the same direction towards Jesus. That's where he describes it. And this is the thing, is that when we become these things, that's countercultural.
When we become generous, selflessly giving ourselves away, that is countercultural, but so too is the process by which we get there. I really believe that. The process, the slow one degree process, is also countercultural. And along the way, I've held on to this quote, and I'd encourage you to as well, from Oswald Chambers when I was 16. I'm not what I want to be. I'm not what I could be. I'm not what I should be. But by the grace of God, I am what I am and not what I was. The kingdom will be built, I think, by people who don't tire of small changes, who are grateful to the grace of God that this day they've changed one degree more into the likeness of Christ. As I said, not settling for small changes. We want to see the whole world renewed. We're going for the big stuff, but the day-by-day life will feel a bit more like this. And the thing is we so often give up when Jesus hasn't. We give up because we haven't seen enough change to satisfy the mindset we have about change. Jesus is in it for the long haul with you. He's put his spirit in you to be with you day by day and seeing you transformed. So why we struggle? One, because doing so is costly, because change is slow, and thirdly, because we think it's contrary to grace. Do you ever get this with these practices, whether it's having a quiet time or whatever it might be? It feels a bit worksy, it feels a bit effort-based and all of this, and I thought we were about grace. And look, like, as a dad with a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, I fully get the struggle to put a quiet time into your life. Like, I am the king of that story of trying to have a quiet time and it not happening. That's why I hold on to Oswald Chambers and Jesus Christ, who are gracious. But it is not contrary to grace. Let me just talk this through a little bit. We have a God of tensions. So he holds things together that we struggle to hold together. He is 3 and 1. His kingdom is now and not yet. He holds those things together. He is the king and creator of the universe and yet our intimate friend. He holds these things together. And in the pursuit of Jesus, we need to hold together two things, grace and effort. And it's really easy to get it mixed up. Here's what Dallas Willard says about it. Grace is not opposed to effort. It is opposed to earning. Just let that sink in. Grace is not opposed to effort. It's opposed to earning. Earning is an action. Effort is an action. Earning is an attitude. And I just want to say right now that as we practice these things as a church, these disciplines, it is never, ever, 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 ever about earning. Ever about earning favor before God. Ever. So if that creeps into your mindset with these things, try and get rid of it as fast as you can. This is what spiritual disciplines are. They're decisions to cooperate with grace. Jesus alone has won us our freedom. He alone has done it. But when he's washed us white as snow, when he has done that gracious work in our life, to then put up trellising, to try and live holy lives, isn't contrary to grace. It's cooperating with the grace of God in our lives. Does that make sense? So if you think about Moses and the Israelites leaving Egypt, so they come out of that oppression by a miracle, and they get to the other side, and then they get these 10 rules of living almost, these ways of living, these practices. Those practices didn't get them free. It wasn't the 10 commandments that got them miraculously out of Egypt. No, it was the soul, it was the action of God, which is a foretaste of the action of Christ on the cross. It's solely him by grace doing that work in our life. But then once we are free, he invites us to stay free, to live and explore and enjoy the gift of the freedom. And that is why they had those 10 ways of living, so they can do that. This is the invitation in all over the New Testament, this combination of grace and effort. If we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. Make some effort to keep in step with the things of God. Therefore, as God's holy, God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion. Like, put this stuff on. Like, I've done the work. I've set you free. I've alone brought you into freedom. Would you choose to live in it? Would you choose to enjoy it and explore it? Rowan Williams says, mature your freedom through grace-filled decision-making. It's possible to be born again and stay an infant of that freedom. His invitation to us is to step into it. And we do that by learning these unforced rhythms of grace. Do we have to Sabbath? No. Is it a gift to us in this world to spend time with Jesus and to stay healthy? Absolutely, it's a gift to us. Why don't we learn how to do it really well? Make mistakes, sure, but why don't we just learn? Why don't we be apprentices of Jesus, who has all these gifts of grace, and just learn to do them in our life, practice them, so that they grow in our lives up the trellising. Fourthly, and we are coming into land, why might we struggle to do this? Because it offends our sense of freedom. So I think, because this is true of me, we almost instinctively try and reject anything that offends our understanding of freedom as being able to do what we want whenever we want. Do you recognize that at all in your life? Like, where there is a common understanding of freedom is you are truly free when you can do what you want whenever you want to do it. That's a free person. And therefore, things like giving things, I don't know, all these different practices, Sabbath, all these different things of restraining and not doing things feels like a limit on your freedom. No. I thought this was Christianity was about freedom. Well, the thing is that the principle has always been that limits lead to life. It is not true that limits take away your freedom in the best sense. So if there are no lines on the football pitch, it's very hard to play the game of football. If when you're married to someone, you sleep with lots of other people, it's very hard for that marriage to flourish. Limits actually lead to life. When in the Garden of Eden, in that story with the apple, there was freedom for Adam to choose it, right? He had the freedom to choose it. But his choice in that moment didn't lead to freedom. Does that make sense? He had the freedom to choose it because we've got freedom, but his choice to choose it didn't lead to freedom. God, we've got to get it that God really knows us and he made us, he designed us. And so if he puts something in place, behind the limit is life, is freedom. If he hadn't chosen that apple, it would have been freedom. The limit was actually the way to life. And so as we're practicing these things and bearing in mind, they're going to be costly. They're going to limit some of the things that we do in our life. It might just be because if we embrace the limit, we will actually find life. And that's my encouragement, just to hold on to that. We crave, I think, creativity and spontaneity. We want to just be spontaneous with our Christian faith. So we want to, like, because we're great, it's about grace and the Spirit, so we just be spontaneous. The thing is that discipline is the birthplace of spontaneity. Ask any jazz musician how they're able to just go all over the place and just improvise. It's because they spent hours and hours and hours and hours practicing. That guy who flew that plane and landed it in the Hudson, and they worked out the odds of being able to do that down to the degree that he landed it were, I don't know, thousands and thousands to one. Why did he do that? Because he spent hours and hours and hours practicing that maneuver. He even learned to glide a plane, so it had no engines. He would be able to spontaneously be able to do exactly what he did that day in New York. It's the same with the spiritual stuff. If you just practice this stuff over time, suddenly, if you cultivate an attitude towards your finances through spiritual disciplines, suddenly when someone really, really needs money, you'll just be like, here you go. It will just spontaneously come. Discipline is the birthplace of spontaneity. Doesn't oppose it. Finally, we're going to struggle to do this because we try and do it alone. I think the same is true of our shame and things like that. We try and keep it to ourselves. Don't tell anyone. We try and keep that alone. The same can be true of the pathway out. We can try and do it alone. And I want to go back to this 6 o'clock abyss thing. So you've had this amazing talk. Not this one. you've had a talk that's amazing by someone else. And then you're like, yes. I'm going to engage. I'm giving my best effort. I fall into the 6 o'clock abyss. How do we not? It's the combination of that moment of truth at 1 o'clock, but then it's spirit-filled habits done in community. And that's the key thing. It's people dragging you across the 6 o'clock abyss that will help us do it. If we try and go alone, it's extremely hard. There's this painting up here. I don't know if you've noticed it. We light it up every week. And it's Moses from this passage in Exodus 17 with Aaron and Hur on either side. And what's happened here is the Amalekites have attacked. The Israelites are traveling, and the Amalekites pounce on them and attack them. And so Joshua goes into battle, and Moses goes up a hill to pray for the battle below. And what happens is whenever Moses is praying and praising God, with his arms held high, the Israelites are winning the battle. But whenever they get tired and weary, the Amalekites start to fight back. And Moses, sure enough, gets weary. He's trying to do it alone, and he gets weary. And so Aaron and Hur come alongside, literally stands shoulder to shoulder, and they hold his arms up in praise and in prayer until the battle is won. That is how we get across the 6 o'clock abyss into the possibility of transformation, is if people come alongside us and we don't try and do it alone. And so this leads us into, like, how are we going to try and do this at KXE? So off the back of tonight, in terms of just like, what now? My encouragement to you, there are twofold. One is now, and one is a little bit later on. The first is now, which is try and hold on to one thing from this series. Try and spot what it was that God was doing, and then find a practice to put up alongside it. Find some trellising. If you're convinced you need to rest more, try Sabbathing. If you're convinced you haven't had a moment of quiet in your mind for months, try solitude, try silence, try turning the phone off, whatever it might be. Try and find some practices that you can engage in. That's the immediate thing. But beyond that is pattern. And if you've been in this church for anywhere up to a couple of years, you'll have heard me in particular, but lots of us talk about pattern a lot. But if you've been here in the last 6 months, you'll have no idea probably what we're talking about. And that's because we started pattern, which is essentially a little tool, a little resource to help you put up trellising in your life and to do it in community in threes and fours. In the pursuit of transformation, to be apprentices of Jesus. So that's what pattern is, and we did it for like a year and a half, learnt a bunch of lessons, and we've just spending 6 months turning it around and sharpening it. So this is going to make a big comeback in October. Put it in the diary. But between now and then, so there's the immediate step, but then there's the one beyond, which is just to think, come October 14th when we start doing pattern again, like, and you might consider getting into one of those threes and fours, to form a kind of community that might help you into transformation. Just over the summer, just be thinking, like, who could I be honest with? That's all it really takes, is ability to, you don't have to have known people for a very long time at all, but like, can I be honest with them, and am I willing to pray with them and let them pray for me? If you've got those two ingredients, I'd just be encouraging you to be thinking about it. It's groups in threes or four, and we're going to kick off again in October. So be chewing on it over the summer. It's just a heads up, really, that that's coming. But that's enough for now. Let's pray. It feels like I've said a lot. It's been a really full-on series where God has done a lot. So it'd be really good to close it by praying for each other. Do you want to stand with me and pray?